Thank you. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank my friend Kay for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to participate in my recovery. I'm always surprised at the number of people who are actually out of bed and in their clothes on Sunday morning. So I'm glad to be here. I want to thank my friends Kathy and Joel for coming to judge me. It's always nice to have somebody in the room who will critique you and tell you the truth after your talk. My friend Christy, who drove me, I was supposed to drive, but I'm old, so I think she got scared. And, no, I'll drive. So this is after I ran into a couple of things parking my car. And so I got a kid in her car, and she's got this little box that tells you what to do. You know, you put in the address where you're going, and it goes, go 10 miles, stay to the left. And it was a little annoying until we actually got off the freeway and made a wrong turn. And then it sort of readjusts to say, okay, now go a quarter of a mile, turn left, and then bear to the right, and then you make the wrong turn, and then it readjusts, and it says, okay, now do this, and it's like, and it pretty soon says, now slap yourself across the face. Pay attention, for God's sake. So we pull up, and there's Kay, and it goes, you've arrived. I said, okay. I think it's an Al-Anon in there, though, you know, it's like, no matter what the alcoholic does, the Al-Anon, like, readjusts and fixes it. Okay, here's your solution now. That was kind of fun. I was going to go home and get one put in my car immediately. I'm really happy to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't that way when I first came to you, but I'm really happy to be here this morning. I'd like to also, before I forget, on behalf of the LA Host Committee for ICIPA, I'd like to extend an invitation to all of you to attend the ICIPA convention next weekend. It's right here at the Bonaventure Hotel. It can't be much closer. You know, we say things like, and ICIPA, the International Conference of Young People, hasn't been in L.A. for almost 40 years. I don't know what y'all did last time they were here, but taking them a long time to come back to Los Angeles. And, you know, we say things like really stupid things like, the young people are the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, you know, that's really kind of stupid because the young people are Alcoholics Anonymous. These folks are putting on a fabulous convention, Unity, Service, and Recovery, something that some of us who have been around for a while don't remember what those things are, the three legacies. So on behalf of them, I'd like to extend an invitation to you to attend and to participate in that conference. It's going to be a very powerful weekend. I am supposed to report to you what it used to be. Oh, and the other thing, I want to welcome our visitor from Louisiana. By God's grace, I never found New Orleans until I was sober. It is my belief this morning that if I had found New Orleans before I found you, I would be dead on the street and with a big smile on my face. I love New Orleans. You're so welcome. I'm glad that, I don't know why you're here, but I'm glad that you're here. I'm supposed to report to you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And, you know, my sponsor always says to me, I should tell you my name and tell you the truth. Well, I've told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm going to tell you the truth. And the reason for that is pretty clear to me. I mean, I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never knew that what it used to be like was going to be important. If I would have known when I was out there that I was going to be here this morning reporting to you what it used to be like, I would have paid more attention to my life. If I would have known when I was out there that it was going to be important, I would have taken notes. I can assure you, if I would have known about steps 4 and 5, I would not have done some of the things that I did. But I didn't know that what it used to be like was going to be important, so I didn't pay a lot of attention. The other thing that I'm a blackout drinker. I love blackouts. I wish we could have blackouts sober. I love blackouts. There's nothing more exciting to me than leaving work on August 12th. Going back on August 20th and discovering you'd been there the entire time. It just makes the time between paychecks so much shorter. But if you're a blackout drinker, it makes what it used to be like a little sketchy. I have a job. I had to get a fingerprint clearance for my job, and I fingerprint really well. I've had a lot of experience fingerprinting. I do it really well. I know how to roll with them. I don't resist it. I don't go too fast. I just roll a real smooth printer, and I was being printed for my job, and I didn't want to raise any red flags, but I said to the woman very casually, I said, well, how far back are you going to check? And she looked me in the eye and said, from the day you were born. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous says more will be revealed. It doesn't say how. So I did the thing. They sent my prints out, and a couple weeks later, I got a phone call. You know how normal people, when they're going to tell us what they think is bad news, they sometimes have a little hesitancy in their voice. And this woman was pretty hesitant when she called me and told me my report had come back. And she said, you know, normally these reports are 2 or 3 pages long. And I said, uh-huh. She said, yours was 56 pages. Do you want to come see it? Well, of course I did. So I went and read that report. And I can tell you, I know a lot more about what it used to be like having read that report than I knew before then. So a lot of what, I mean, my story's hearsay. And I like story, so I keep telling it, but it may not even be true. I didn't have my first drink of alcohol until I was 13 years old, and I'm really, really sorry I waited that long. But I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I don't remember ever thinking, I can't wait until I drink. I certainly never thought I would never drink, but I never really thought about alcohol at all. And yet when I was 13 years old, I was on a camping trip. We were camping just south of Oceanside on the beach. I remember that Friday night getting into the tent, and I had a bottle of vodka in my pillowcase. And to this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. I've always believed it was the grace of God. But I've never been able to confirm that. And I remember, I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me, but I remember being excited about having it. And I took the top off, and I asked if anybody wanted any, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I drank half the bottle, and I looked around the tent, and nothing had gotten different, nothing had changed, so I drank the second half of the bottle, and that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never got resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never had resentments out there. Never had resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. One of my early resentments here was I heard you talk about your first drink, and you talked about taking the drink, and you described how it felt in your mouth, and you talked about how it felt as it went down your throat, and you somehow traced it to your stomach, and you talked about it hitting your stomach and exploding. It went to your fingernails and your toenails, and you grew a couple inches taller, and you dropped 20 pounds, and your pimples fell off. Wonderful things happened to you, and that simply wasn't the case for me. I had my first drink of alcohol, and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes, and at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me was I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief this morning that if you were to drink a quart of anything, in about 15 minutes, you'd have to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the house, out of the tent, and I shuffled through the sand to the outhouse, and I went in and went to the bathroom, and when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed in the toilet seat. I couldn't move. I couldn't even blink. I didn't feel my heart beating, and I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed in the toilet seat. And, of course, later in my drinking, I did discover that two people can use the same toilet at the same time if the second person is very careful about what they're doing. But that was a visual. Yeah. But I didn't know that at 13. I did somehow, though, know that the body was made up of energy. And I somehow figured, if I can gather my energy, I'm going to be all right. So I've always referred to it as my first formal meditation. Because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be all in one place, when it seemed to be centrally located, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, you've explained to me that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy as in the Marines, as being dive bombed, as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I always have to tell you, my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I've always contended under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. When I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. I hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, the floor of the tent. I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I didn't want to be in the tent either, so I got out of there. And that was my first drink of alcohol. And it was the most wonderful, incredible, marvelous, magnificent, spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I understand they don't make it with alcohol anymore, which really kind of is a bummer. But I used to buy it by the six-pack. I remember the day the guy at the market called me over, and he said, "Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore." He says, "I can't believe anybody vapes as much as you do." And I got cut off from that supply. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I still, if you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely and laugh at your neck. It's dangerous for me in Kansas City. They wear a lot of Taboo in Kansas City, but I'm often tempted to introduce myself and say I'm Patty and I'm a pig, because I'm the person. I came to your house and ate and drank everything in your bathroom, and you wonder, how do we know that? How do we know to do that? I mean, my next-door neighbors don't know to do that. My next-door neighbors have been to my house. They have never drank anything in my bathroom. I mean, it's just... And how do we know? We just have this sense. It's kind of like that GPS thing. We have this sense about us. We just know. My next-door neighbors are very strange. I have to tell you, they're normal people, which kind of really fascinates me. It's kind of a study in itself, but... They're like a man and a woman that have been married to each other forever. And as far as I know, they've never cheated on one another, which makes no sense to me at all. And they will open a beer between the two of them, one, a beer. And the one who's not holding the beer doesn't seem to care that they're not holding the beer. And then when one of them drinks the beer, the other one isn't monitoring how much they're drinking. And then they'll put the beer down. Nobody will be holding the beer. The beer will be being ignored for minutes. It seems like hours. Almost a day will go by. And then one of them will say to the other, "Honey, where's the beer?" "Honey doesn't know where the beer is." "I know where the beer is. And I'm next door." How do we know this stuff? But, I had an opportunity to go to college. I'm a chronic alcoholic now. I'm drinking on a daily basis, only I don't know it. I mean, how many of us knew? I don't know I'm an alcoholic. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on I had no choice. I don't know. I go to college. I went to San Diego State. I graduated from San Diego State with a 3.8 grade point average. I share that with you because it almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I got here, I told you it's too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. I'm a chronic hopeless alcoholic. I'm a blackout drinker. And I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average. I stayed in San Diego and took classes for a master's degree. I'm one of those people, if I'm doing something well, I want to keep doing it. Apparently, I do school well. So I stayed and took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego because I'd taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. My disease manifests itself in rationalization, justification, and denial. No matter what it is I do, I explain to you why I'm doing it. As I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing it. As I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I think I'm leaving San Diego because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because I have a roommate who's a little annoyed with me. And I'm going to tell you about my roommate. Even as a chronic alcoholic, I have a tremendous amount of compassion. And I'm a bar drinker. I'm a living room drinker, an alley drinker, a car drinker, a dumpster drinker, and I don't specialize, I just drink. But I love bars. I love sleazy, nasty, disgusting bars. The ones with the sawdust on the floor, the mirrors are cracked, you kind of have to dip to see yourself in there. The culture around the bars ripped where people tried to hold on as they're falling off their bars. It's always a nice touch if there's a piece of broken furniture in a corner somewhere. And I understand you can't smoke in a bar anymore, which makes no sense to me. I drank in bars where guys would take a piss against the wall. Apparently they can still do that, but they can't smoke in there. But they used to be full of smoke, and they had that wonderful used booze urine smell that I I salivate still when I think of that. I love that smell. In fact, sometimes if I'm in a cranky mood, I'll go buy one of those joints, open the door, take a hit off of that, and it just perks me up for the rest of the day. I love that smell. But what fascinates me is the quality of people who drank in those places. I mean, there were CEOs of really big companies, bank presidents, admirals in the Air Force, neurosurgeons. I mean, that's what they said they were. And I... But the guys had, they're very, very, and I'm sure none of you will identify with this, but the guys who drank in the bars that I drank in had very little creativity. They had two basic lines: my wife doesn't understand, and I have no place to stay tonight. Typically the end of their dialogue, but I have a lot of compassion, a tremendous amount of compassion. So some guy would come on to me with one of those lines, and I would say, look, I'll take you home with me tonight, but I don't want to talk to you again until the bar closes. So the bar would close, being a lady of my word, I would take this guy home with me. We would get to my house, I would send him into the bedroom, telling him I had to go to the bathroom. I would send him into the bedroom on the right, and then I would go into my bedroom on the left, and I had just sent him in with my roommate. Now, some nights, that was okay with her. Some nights, she didn't mind at all. Other nights, within a matter of minutes, there'd be all this banging at my door, which I'd, of course, well, I mean, I had 7 o'clock classes. I had to get some sleep. Lock my door. But if it would have always been okay or never been okay, I'd have been all right. But she was so inconsistent. You'd have drank if you lived with her. She was so inconsistent. I don't think I'm leaving because she's annoyed with me. I think I'm leaving because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because I have one more drunk driving assault charge pending. Another resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out here you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that I was getting arrested for drunk driving assault. It had something to do with how I got out of the car. And here's the thing. I'm driving down the road. The light comes on behind me. I pull over. The officer comes up. The first thing I do is slam my car door open. Now, my intent is to knock him in the private parts. Men are a little fussy about their private parts. So as the door's flying open, he jumps back to protect himself. And when he jumps back, it's really a good thing because now he's far enough away that I can get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try and I'd go for him. And it'd be a really good fight for a couple of minutes. But I was a lot younger then, too. But I wouldn't remember that back at the car. He had a friend. And the friend had a radio. And the friend would call some more friends. And pretty soon it'd be 3 or 4 of them. One of me, it's not fair anymore. I'd say, well, and they'd take me away. Next time the light comes on behind me, I'd pull over. The officer walks up. I slam the car door open, try and knock him in the private parts. He jumps back to protect himself. He gets far enough away to get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I could take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try and then go for him. It'd be a really good fight for a minute, but I wouldn't remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. Pretty soon, be 4 or 5 of them, one of me. It's not fair anymore, it's not until they take me away. And I didn't do that once or twice. I did that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. Never remembered the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over, and I think the results are going to be different. This time it's a fair fight. This time I'm going to take him. And when you get out of the car like that, they attach an assault charge. They don't even care that they won the fight. Drunk driving assault, drunk driving assault. And I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing, but I drank during a time when the state of California didn't get their underwear in such a knot about drunk driving. I understand they're pretty testy about it now, but... I never really had any consequence. Well, I lost my driver's license, but you don't really need that to drive a car. But I drank during a time where you just call your attorney. You paid him $1,000, which was a lot of money, but you pay him $1,000, he'd write a letter, he'd make a phone call, whatever he'd do, and that was kind of the end of it. You never heard any more about it. But one time I had 2 pending at the same time, and my attorney was nervous. And I think if your attorney's nervous, you ought to worry about it. So I'm sitting in a bar worrying about the fact that my attorney's nervous. And I struck up a conversation with this guy sitting next to me, and as luck would have it, he worked in a mortuary. And I came up with a plan. I think alcoholics, I think we come up with really good plans really quickly. I think the good news in Alcoholics Anonymous is we have an opportunity to run those past somebody else. But we went to the mortuary. We got a death certificate. We put my name on it. We filled out all the pertinent information. We forged a doctor's signature, and we sent it to the court. Because they really can't expect a lot from you if you're dead. So I called my attorney and I told him he didn't need to worry. He didn't worry. I didn't worry. Nobody worried for, I don't know, a month, 6 weeks, maybe 2 months. I don't know. And the light came on behind me. And I pulled over. And that time the judge wanted to see me. And I couldn't figure out why he wanted to see me. He never wanted to see me before. But hey, what the heck? I went. I'll never forget him looking at me. He said, "Miss Ochoa, tell me, how is it a dead person is standing in my court?" I shrugged my shoulders with all sincerity. I said, "I don't know. Bad luck." And that's what I thought it was. It was bad luck. It was circumstances and conditions. It was the cops. It was you and they and them. It was a lot of things. Never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. Never occurred to me. I thought I drank what I wanted to drink. But I don't think I'm leaving San Diego because I've got another drunk driving assault charge pending. I think I'm leaving because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I was offered a job in Chico, California, which is about as far north as you can get. I loaded everything I owned into my car. I took 2 bottles of booze, 2 cases of beer, and I headed north. I got to Santa Ana, which really isn't the place you want to shoot for, but I got to Santa Ana. I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. And I have a sense I can find the sleepiest bar without even looking for it. I pulled off the freeway, pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in. It was full of smoke, had that wonderful used booze, urine smell. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. That's as far north as I ever got, 88 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my lover, my friend, my companion, my support. And at some point it had turned, and I've always believed it was in the middle of my first drink, but at some point it had turned, it began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, decency, integrity, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings. And long before I got to you, it had taken it all. Long before I got to you, alcohol controlled every area of my life. Where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from. And I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that I didn't have a choice. I went into the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top. And that, too, almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I got here, I told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. What I didn't tell you about is in the newspaper business, and we often gave awards. And I didn't tell you about the times I would come out of a blackout standing behind a podium much like this in a room full of people holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Kiwanis Club, and I'd have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous with what I prayed God with my last drunk driving assault. In 1975, the state of California was starting to get just a little annoyed with people barreling down the freeway at 80 miles an hour, blowing something in the breathalyzer above their grade point average. And I'm the kind of person, I get released from jail, I always get the arrest report and read it. I always read the arrest report so that I can practice it so that next time I'll get that part right. And you see, I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew there'd be a next time. I had a high-profile job. The cops were always looking for me. They knew what I drove. They knew what I drove if I had my car. They knew what I drove if I had your car. They knew what I drove if I had a rental car. They knew what I drove if I had a stolen car. They were always looking for me. So I practiced field sobriety tests a lot. By when I prayed God with my last drunk driving assault, I was doing really, really well on the field sobriety test. In fact, I mentioned to the officer I thought I was doing A-plus work. By the end, I knew to walk. I knew how to walk. I knew touch your finger to your nose means this. It doesn't mean that. This morning, I could still stand on 1 foot for 45 minutes. I mean, I'm really, really good at field sobriety tests. And at the end of it, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before, I had responded with, "Well, I can't even do that sober." Well, then I had just confessed, and they took me away. So on the last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, "Okay," and I turned around. So you think it's funny. He wasn't even amused. I just turned around. He cuffed me. He took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in the cell with criminals. And there were real criminals in there. There were prostitutes in there. There were burglars. Women who'd been arrested for beating their husbands, which I don't think should be a crime, but in California they lock you up for it. And I knew I didn't belong there, so I tried to organize a prison break. And I came up with a really simple plan, and I explained it very slowly to the criminals. And it was an easy plan. We're going to get our coffee cups. We're going to bang them on the bars. When the marshal comes to see what's going on, I'm throwing my arm around her neck. We're getting her keys, and we're getting out of here. And I heard something I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those criminals looked at me and she said, "Why don't you sit down and shut up?" And I said, "Fine, then y'all stay, but I'm getting out." And I was going like a mad woman on those bars. Couple problems with styrofoam cups. First one is they don't make a lot of noise. The second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. And when the bars ate them up and it got to my knuckles and it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. And I got released from jail on an OR. I knew they were making a mistake, but I didn't think I should be the one to tell them about it. I was 26 years old. I went to court on that charge. I was drunk that morning in court. It's the only way I went to the laundromat, the grocery store. It's the only way I did anything. I went to court that morning drunk, and because the state of California was starting to get upset as a result of my past record, I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. I have a son as a direct result of my alcoholism. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control. This kid did nothing. He did nothing. He went and he cried. He would not go get a job. He was 8 months old. He just kind of interfered with my life a lot, and I didn't like him. But I was willing to use him that morning. And I told the judge he couldn't put me in jail because I was a single parent. I was self-supporting to my own contributions. And he told me he would put my son in a foster home because I was an unfit mother. And I would have admitted to being a lot of things. But I did not believe I was an unfit mother. I had that kid with me every day of the week, whether he wanted to be with me or not. And he was to spend the first 11 months of his life in one of those plastic things that you put kids in when you don't want to touch them, sitting on a pool table in a smoke-filled bar. But I believe because I had him with me made me a fit mother. And my son was going to a foster home, and I was going to prison. And in the middle of sentencing me, I know the judge was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because the expression on his face changed. The tone of his voice got different. And he looked at me and he said, "I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance." And he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wish I could tell you I took the alternative. I came here, worked the 12 steps, and skyrocketed to recovery. And if Harvey wasn't here, I would tell you that story. But that's not my story. Sometimes when I'm out of state, I tell it, you know. But that's not my story. I sit in the courtroom and I thought about it. Jail, alternative. Jail, I've been to jail. There's more alcohol and other drugs inside the institution if you know what to do, who to do it to, and you're willing to go to any lengths, and I always was. Jail alternative. I had the public defender putting his elbow in my ribs the day the $1,000 attorneys were gone. The only thing I'd wanted to do since I was in the fourth grade was be a writer. I had an opportunity to go into that profession. I gave it up for one more drink. Anything to drink, it was one more drink. I gave up my profession. Drank myself out of my profession of choice. I had the public defender standing next to me, putting his elbow in my ribs, trying to get me to make a decision. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill writes something that's very profound. He writes something to the effect, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or live by spiritual principles. And then he goes on to say, this is not always an easy decision for us. And that's where I was that morning. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live by spiritual principles, this is not always an easy decision for us. And I stood there thinking about it. And I didn't know why that morning, but I know why this morning. I didn't know why then. While I was trying to think about it, as clear as I had known, and as drunk as I was, as clear as I had known anything, I knew that morning that if I was to go to jail one more time, I would either die in the institution or I'd be institutionalized for life. I had a moment of clarity in that courtroom. Die in the institution or be institutionalized for life. And I took the alternative, and I left the courtroom, and I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it had been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol, but I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know what ANA was. I thought it was something like the PTA or Parents Without Partners, and a lot of days it is. But as far as I know, I had never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous before. I had no idea what you people would do to me or for me. My first meeting was a speaker meeting. I can't tell you who talked that night, but I heard two things. I heard we don't drink between meetings. Well, I quickly looked around and didn't see any of you drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you're not drinking in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? And I don't know how this impacted other newcomers, but it made me really, really nervous. I couldn't figure out why the judge sent me to a place where people didn't drink. I would have understood if he sent me to Sears School of Safe Driving. I did not understand why he sent me to a place where people didn't drink. And the other thing I heard in that meeting was the answers were in that book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. I can't tell you how irritated I was. I went home and read the book. Not only could I not find the answers in it, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to go back and get the right one, and I'm a thief. It's humiliating for a thief to have stolen, and I don't know I'm a thief. I stayed sober for a while. My sponsor told me I was a thief. I think it's important that you have a sponsor. I think it's critical you have a sponsor who's not as emotionally involved in your life as you are. It kind of irritates me at times, but she has a whole different perspective of my life. Here's the thing. I'm in a bar drinking. The bar closes. I pick up some keys. I go out and get in the car, and I'm driving myself home. Now, my sponsor in the San Diego police think this is Grand Theft Auto. I think it's alternative transportation. I just need to get home. I come to your house and pick up a few things. I think it's shopping. We had a kid in our area who was 16 years old, and he had celebrated a year's sobriety, which is a huge, huge deal. And his mother had this party for him, and she was really, really proud, and which she should be, and had this party for her son. And I have no idea how to behave in the world. None. Everything I know because I've watched the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I know about being in the world, I know because I've seen you do it. You've shared your experience, and you've said, Patty, take my experience, take it into the world and live it, and then it will become your experience. So everything I know, I've learned from you. I know how to be so. I have no social skills. The book talks about we become disgustingly and dangerously antisocial. I didn't become that way. It started out that way. I've developed one social skill in the last 31 years. I haven't used it yet today, so it's still, you know, pretty fresh. But the only way I know how to live out there is by watching you. So I watch you. You go to one another's house and you say, oh, what a lovely home you have. So I know how to do that. So I go to this kid's birthday, and his mother opens the door to let me in, and I say, oh, what a lovely home you have. And she said, would you like to see the rest of it? I said, oh, no, I can't. I shop. This poor woman followed me the entire time. You know, I went in to go to the bathroom. I came out. She frisked me. But I think it's shopping, rationalization, justification, and denial. No matter what it is I do, I explain to you why I'm doing it. As I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing this, I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And so I don't know that I'm a thief, but I've gotten the wrong book. It's like, oh my God, I'm going to have to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book. The only reason I came back was to get the answer book. I don't think it matters why you come back. I don't think it matters what your motive is, what your intentions are, what your desires are. I think what's important is what your actions are. Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I came to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book. That's the only thing I wanted. And I've been coming back ever since. That was a small discussion meeting, and in that meeting I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. I mean, some of you had nice cars. I know how to get those. Some of you had nice jewelry. If you stood next to me during the Lord's Prayer, if your rings were loose, they were mine. I mean, some of you have nice spouses. We all know how to get those. We don't keep them well, but we know how to get them. I could not figure out what it was you had, and then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants, not like the kids do today. I haven't seen any baggy pants this morning. I work with teenagers who wear pants that have absolutely no relationship to their body size. They're like, they could put a homeless family in there with them. These weren't that baggy, but they were baggy. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, but the holes were there where they should have been, and he nodded out during the meeting. And I quickly assessed the situation. I figured he's shooting heroin. Folks who shoot heroin, not out. And I can probably do this thing and not drink if I can shoot a little heroin. So I found out where he worked. The next day I snuck down to his office and I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's out of jail and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink. So I guarantee you won't get drunk. If you don't get drunk, it's different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my family life would get better, my job life would get better, my finances would get better, my relationships would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful. Because none of it has. A little hope for the newcomer leaving. But it's all gotten different. As I stand here this morning, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. See, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going to do something I think is good for me, and it generally turns out to be bad for me. And I'm going to do something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. And I don't know good from bad for me. I've gone through times in the last 31 years that seemed incredibly painful. I've gone through some hideous times in the last 31 years, and I'm pretty dramatic, so I always refer to it as the dark night of the soul. Unless, of course, you're going through it, then I just tell you to get over yourself. But in those times, if I don't drink and don't dine, don't drink and don't dine, I've moved far enough beyond it to, in retrospect, see that every time I thought my life was falling apart, what was really happening is it was falling together. And it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where He had me be. You see, I left to my own devices, I'll shortchange myself. The only thing I wanted when I came to you was to stay out of jail. If I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. If a single day in the last 31 years I'd had my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. God has a plan for me beyond my wildest imagination. I have a pretty wild imagination, but beyond my wildest imagination, there's a plan for me. And sometimes God's got to kick me in the butt. I'm one of those people, I dig a rut, I get comfortable, I decorate. It's like right here, right now, life is enough, life is good, life is magnificent. I'm just content right here, right now, but God's plan for me is bigger than right here, right now. So sometimes I need a kick in the butt to get out of the rut for God to move me to where, and sometimes that's a little painful. So you don't drink, you don't dine, you move far enough beyond it to, in retrospect, see that every time I thought my life was falling apart, what was really happening is it was falling together. And I believe that old man. I hadn't believed another human being in a very long time. But I believe that old man, and I know this morning the reason that I believed him. I hadn't believed, I hadn't trusted another human being. People hurt me all my life. They disappointed me. They let me down. I learned a long time ago that if I trusted you, you were going to hurt me. And I hadn't trusted or believed anybody in a long time, but I believe that old man, and I know why this morning. Because of the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. One alcoholic talking to another. One alcoholic talking to another goes through that brick wall that we have built between us and the rest of the world. And I believe that old man. I have the books every night. I'd open it to the line, the chapter that says, most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. I'd say amen and close the book, and I was reading the book. I go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where they have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee. On the way out, I'd say hi to him, to the manager. He'd say, hi, Patty. I was talking to another alcoholic. My court program said I had to go to two meetings a week. I thought that was really obsessive, but I was willing to go to any length to stay out of jail. So I went to the two meetings a week my court program said I had to go to, and the only thing I did right is I didn't drink. And I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And like I said, I've been in pain in the last 31 years. Sometimes life's painful, not just for alcoholics, but for everybody. I've been in pain in the last 31 years, but I have never been in the kind of pain that I was in 8.5 months away from my last drink. The pain of not drinking and not recovering. The pain of not drinking and not recovering is the greatest pain I've ever been in. And 8.5 months away from my last drink, that pain drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I took the first step of recovering in Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. That whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose. Whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. Whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose. And I'm the kind of person, I dream dreams and I plan plans, but I can't get off the bar stool and get it done because alcohol controls every year of my life. When I drink alcohol, I have no choices. I have dreams and I make plans, but I have no choices. My life had become unmanageable. Alcohol controlled every area of my life. Alcohol controlled what I would do and who I would do it with and who I would do it to. And I have no choices. And it took 8.5 months of not drinking for me to get far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. You all saw it when I walked in. It was piled this high. But you gave me the dignity to do what I had to do for as long as I had to do it. Until I got far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. I wish I could tell you then that I looked at the rest of the steps, I knew there were solutions and problems in my life, worked them all in a nanosecond, skyrocketed to recovery. But the truth for me is I have never worked the next one of the 12 steps to recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, so my back was against the wall. It was do it or die, and I had no other choice. I will use every other idea I can think of. I will use every other plan I can think of. I will do everything else I can think to do before I become willing to look at the next one of the 12 steps to recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stand here this morning and I can tell you, I have worked the steps exactly the way they're written in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, there is no way to get from where I was to where I am this morning, except through the power and the magic of those steps. The person who I am this morning is nothing like the person who walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on October 4th, 1975. The best I've ever described myself. When I came here, I was an animal with latent human tendencies. That's what walked through the door. Because the steps work and because you've been willing to share with me, I become very kind, very loving, very gentle, very caring. course, now they're telling me it's codependency and I have to recover from it. But I love the person who I am. I'm tempted to write a book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. And I am the woman that I am because the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you have been willing to share your experience, strength, and hope with me. Because you've been willing to share with me how you live out in the world without taking a drink of alcohol. You have shown me on a daily basis how to live out there without taking a drink of alcohol. You have never told me what to do. You have always shown me what to do. My son was 11 months old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I brought him with me because I didn't know what else to do with him. All of a sudden you have a child. It's a little frightening. And so I would bring him to a meeting with me, and one of you would take him and you'd hold him and whatever you do with him, and at the end of the meeting you'd give him back to me. And I'd bring him to another meeting. And my son, everything my son knows, he learned from the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's taught him how to be kind and how to be loving and gentle and how to be caring. He also taught him how to kind of manipulate, and I've never been thrilled with that, but apparently you have to take the good with the bad. And I share that with you because if just sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous were enough, my son would have never had a problem. But just sitting in a meeting is not...